This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Beware!
They seem to be on the attack. A mother of four has been told she cannot do anything to disturb the seagulls nesting on her roof. After one of them pecked to death the family's Yorkshire Terrier in front of her horrified son. Isn't this ghastly? Emily Vincent is worried the gulls could now attack her children. Herring gulls... How do you tell a herring gull from other gulls, by the way? ...are highly protective of their offspring and will attack anyone who gets too close. Roo, the terrier, had to be put down last Thursday after gulls swooped down and pecked him in the head. The attack was witnessed by Jace, who is three, who's now scared to go outside. And, well, you can't blame him and doesn't want to go out the back door. This all happened in St. Colum Minor near Newquay in Cornwall. And the mother's asked her local council what can be done about the birds, and she's been warned harming them or disturbing the nest is a criminal offence. This is awful. Emily Vincent tells the Times, Jace was with Roo in the garden, then all of a sudden Jace started screaming, Roo is bleeding. I ran into the kitchen and saw Roo lying on his side. There was blood everywhere. Roo had managed to run indoors and then collapsed. Blood was coming out of his head. It was like a murder scene. Well, I doubt if it was quite like that. I couldn't get any sense out of Jace initially. Then he kept saying, the big bird has got a sharp beak. Mrs. Vincent is now understandably concerned. Her children, Jesse, who's one, Jace, who I've mentioned already, the poor lad, the three-year-old who witnessed all of this, nine-year-old Jasmine and Jade, who's 14, and two Maltese terriers, gosh, it's all going on in this house, Millie and Lewis, could be hurt next, but the council are sticking to their line. So how much danger are we in? Have you ever been attacked or swooped on by a gull? Let's speak with Don Foster, who's a former Lib Dem MP for Bath, who has concerns about gulls. And you've done something about this in the past, haven't you, Don? Good morning.
Good morning. And, of course, I appreciate them. You know, we only got to look at what's going on in Greece to know there are slightly more important issues than seagulls. But well, let's be honest, they are causing a huge amount of damage. They cause a lot of problems through noise. They can open rubbish sacks and let other vermin come in. And it's literally costing millions and millions of pounds. So for a number of years, I've been saying, look, we need to do something. And whenever I look at all of the measures that have been tried, whether it's putting up hawks or oiling the eggs or putting up wire meshes and netting and all of this, none of it works. The population's gone up and up. So I've been arguing what we need is some proper research so we understand more about the urban seagull and why it is that their numbers have doubled in the last 10 years and that the situation is getting worse. And until we have that research, cost a small amount of money, we're not going to have a solution that works. So I got the government to agree to do it. The Lib Dems lost in the election, as everybody knows, and Osborne's just announced he's pulled the plug on that very small amount of money for some research. Daft.
How much would it have cost, Don?
£250,000. It sounds a lot of money, but when you compare, if you take just Bristol, just one city, over £1 million a year is spent on just netting over some of their big buildings every single year. £1 million a year. Now, multiply that right around the country for netting, for spikes, for putting up hawks, and all the other measures they've tried, none of which work because the population goes up and up and up. You can see that a small amount of money invested now in research to help us save millions of pounds would have been quite sensible, and I genuinely don't understand why Osborne's pulled the plug on it.
Don Foster, thank you. Former Lib Dem MP for Bath. Listening, Keith Perks, who's from Pest Force in Cornwall. How much of a problem is it in Cornwall? Good morning.
Good morning. It is a major issue with them. I mean, the biggest problem is holidaymakers come down here and think it's a good pastime to feed the birds, encourage them. They are an aggressive bird. And the problem is they have moved into the towns. We have an issue now, essentially, where our water environment is that clean that there's not enough rubbish in the water, as in, effluent, which used to be there, feeding the fish. So if there's no fish out on the sea, the birds are coming in where there's free meals. And rubbish bags and everything else is the main thing. They do cause a lot of disruption, but they've been protected, supposedly under the illusion that they are in decline.
You don't agree with that, Mr. Perks? You don't think they are in decline?
No, I don't. The numbers are increasing year on year. I mean, these birds live between 25 and 30 years. So, yeah, if you have a pair nest on your roof, usually the mature birds will hatch out 2 eggs. So that's 2 chicks next year looking to nest on your roof or your neighbour's roof. I mean, I do a lot of netting and proofing, to try and reduce the gulls nesting. But, they are becoming out of control. It is time. I mean, France, south of France, they have a period in the year where they cull the birds. They don't want to eradicate them because they are part of the ecosystem. But it's got, it's got beyond a joke over here really now.
How aggressive are they? Have you ever been pecked?
When you're up there on the rooftops trying to remove nests or whatever, because you've got licenses to do so, yes, it's nothing. I mean, I wear a safety helmet.
Yes.
Because they will hit you as hard as they can. But they're only doing what they believe is right. They're protecting their nest.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a heck of a beak they've got on them, Mr. Perks.
It most definitely is.
And you felt it on more than one occasion?
Most definitely. Good job I've had a helmet on. I have actually had my head split open by them.
You've had your head split open by a gull?
Yes, yeah.
Well, how did that happen?
Well, I was removing a nest at the time and didn't bother to put the helmet on.
Wow. Okay, well, thank you. Mr. Perks is from Pest Force Cornwall. They are vicious. Have you ever been attacked by a seagull? In Harrow, Jeremy, they don't come into Harrow, do they, Jeremy?
Yes, we've got loads of them on Kenton Recreation Ground, and at certain times of year, they're a damn nuisance. They attack songbirds, they attack the pets, they are scavengers, and one of the reasons there's been a huge increase is the amount of old takeaways thrown away, rubbish bins and rubbish bags, there's food in there. There is no natural predator apart from us, and here's a stunning omission. I've shot a couple with my air rifle.
I think that's illegal.
No, it's not. How can it be illegal? They are not a protected species.
Hang on. You can't shoot birds with an air rifle.
Done it. Yes, I can, and I've done it. And I will do it again, because they are a threat at that time of year. There are children around, there are pets around. No, Nick.
Jeremy, am I right in thinking that you were once a councillor?
Yes, so what?
Someone who held a position of civic authority should be aware of the Wildlife and Countryside Act of 1981.
Well, then how can I... then I can kill rats. I can shoot squirrels. In actual fact, if you...
We're talking about birds.
Former councillor,
I would like to remind you of the Wildlife and Countryside Act of 1981 and the Wildlife Order of 1985.
I am not interested, because the fact is...
You are a lawbreaker.
Yes, exactly. I am a lawbreaker, and I'm a lawbreaker protecting my property, my pets.
I don't know if you've noticed, we don't live in Texas. We do not have the right to do whatever we so desire to protect our property.
We should live in Texas, because then the council wouldn't be pushing us around as much as they are, telling us that we cannot protect our own...
It is illegal to intentionally... recklessly injure or kill a gull, damage or destroy an active nest or its contents.
Who said anything? Nick, but here's the thing. It says recklessly. I wasn't being reckless.
Intentionally or recklessly. Yeah, deliberately. You have just convicted yourself. You are guilty. What sentence do I give this man? Can we get what he's... Coming up, the sentence... Sorry, go on. In mitigation, I'll give you a briefcase in mitigation.
I'll tell you what the sentence should be.
No. In mitigation, I will be giving you your sentence after the travel update. This is your last chance for mitigation. What would you like to put before the court?
I'm not going for mitigation. I'm telling you, it is my property, my
That's
family,
mitigation.
My pets, and I will deal with it. I see.
Are you honestly telling me that you? Are you honestly telling me, may it please the court, that you, your family, or any of your pets you thought were in direct possible harm or possible way of harm from the gulls? What led you to believe that?
Well, because they tend to mob her.
They tend to. So they hadn't mobbed her, being your wife, I assume.
No. Tend means is that what that's what they do. That is their tendency.
Yeah,
to
but
do
you
it.
Ha- they hadn't. When you say her, do you mean your wife or your pet or what? What is it?
Me, I saw him swooping around the garden because I'm not going to do it anymore because I used to be putting food out for the birds. I don't put it out anymore.
So you deliberately invited birds into your garden. By the act of putting out food, this was a honey trap. You set a honey trap for a gull, and then you intentionally killed it.
No, it's a bread trap. No, not at all. No, no.
It was a booby trap. No, you are a gull booby trapper.
But the gulls haven't got boobies. It's a different bird anyway.
You are a bird killer.
Yes.
What did you do with the bodies?
They got buried.
So how many gulls have you killed? How long ago was this?
Oh, about 5 years.
What did the kids say?
Absolutely nothing at all.
They think it's normal for their father to wander around like something out of Deer Hunter. Gull Hunter. You are the Gull Hunter of Harrow.
Well, in actual fact, I mean, it's quite normal for pests to be taken out, for example, in the
taken
countryside.
Taken out? Who am I talking to? Rambo?
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
To other matters, do you think pornography, or the study of pornography, by the way, not pornographic images, obviously, but a study in a sense and of the impact of pornography should be part of a child sex education? Green Party MP Caroline Luke has presented a bill to Parliament demanding sex and relationships education be compulsory in schools. She wants what's known as PSHE... No, me neither, but it's personal, social, health and economic education to be a statutory requirement for state-funded schools, which includes teaching pupils about ending violence against women and girls, and an understanding of pornography and the media portrayal of certain images. Ms. Lucas's personal, social, health and economic education statutory requirement bill was given a first reading by 183 votes. It's unlikely to become law without support of the government or sufficient parliamentary time, but it could, therefore, get there. Now, what Caroline Lucas says, she's not available for interview, unfortunately, but she talks about how difficult it is for young people to, quote, navigate the tricky world of sex and relationships. She talks about how pornography plays a key role in shaping how young people feel about their bodies, about relationships, about one another. She goes on, along with other media, pornography tends to objectify women, and several studies have demonstrated the link between this objectification and both sexist attitudes and violence against women and girls. I'll just give that to you again. You suggesting then that pornographic magazines, and I suppose videos, DVDs, whatever it might be, television stations, mean that can lead to violence against women and girls? So it should be part of the studies in our schools. Do you agree? If your children are still at school and you've just dropped them off this morning? Or perhaps they are in the process of breaking up. Kid is going up to big school, as it's called, this September. Should they learn about... When I say learn about, I'm not for one second suggesting that they'll be shown pornographic images, but learn about the impact of them. Jane Lees chairs the Sex Education Forum. What do you reckon, Jane Lees? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. I think the main thrust of Caroline's bill is that... children and young people should have an opportunity to learn about positive sex and relationships in school alongside what they learn outside from parents and other people. And that should be the main thrust against protecting them against the difficult images that they might see through using social media and the internet.
And an understanding of pornography, how important or otherwise might that be?
I don't think it's about understanding pornography. It's about understanding the normal human body, its functions, the way in which humans reproduce, what happens to you when you grow up, what you should expect in a relationship, what makes for a positive relationship.
What should you expect in a relationship? The
kind of feelings that change once puberty kicks in.
What should you expect in a relationship?
Yeah, difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you just said it, though. Well, I mean, what should one expect from a relationship?
Well, you shouldn't expect to be abused and controlled by a partner. You shouldn't expect a boyfriend or girlfriend to want to know where you are all the time or to take charge of your mobile phone. You shouldn't expect physical violence in a relationship. All of those things are not normal. And children and young people have to have some opportunity to think about those kind of things in the environment of the classroom.
And this should be compulsory for children from the age of what, would you say?
Well, the whole programme of personal, social, health and economic education, and well done for getting that right.
Someone wrote it out for me, don't worry.
Yes, the whole programme, including the beginnings of sex and relationships education, should start as soon as schooling starts, in a very simple way. There are lots
What do you mean, five? Four?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Four?
Yeah. Well, as soon as they... As soon
you
as
want to... Oh, the poor little loves it. They're still trying to learn about plasticine and counting. Why the hell have we got to tell them about intercourse?
Also, children are, sometimes for the first time, they're mixing with large groups of other children.
Yes, they're just mixing. They're not trying to get off with them.
No. You're perpetrating the myth that PSHE and sex and relationships education is about teaching.
Why can't children be children?
About how to have sex, and it's nothing to do with that.
Well, what? Okay, how do we tailor this? The all important message that you're getting across. How do we tailor that for a 4 year old?
For a 4 year old, it would start with the kind of relationships that they're familiar with, which is with their friends and with their family.
What's that got to do with sex?
And understanding who looks after them. Who they can go to for help, but also understanding what to do when things happen to them that they feel uncomfortable about. Let me give you an example.
What, like inappropriate advances or something?
Let me give you an example.
Yeah, please.
Something very simple would be touching one another. You do have to teach some small children not to be all over other children, either in an aggressive way or a smothering way. They have to learn about boundaries. Now, one of the things that teachers might do is introduce the idea of nice and nasty touches. What kind of touches feel good and which kind of ones make you feel uncomfortable? And that might lead on to which parts of your body are private.
Therefore,
alerting children in a very uncontroversial way to the fact that if they feel uncomfortable about certain kinds of things that might be happening to them, then they should go and tell a trusted adult like their teacher or maybe parent or relative.
Of course, the trouble is the parent might sometimes be involved, or I suppose the teacher. Please stay on the line, Jane Lisa. I just want to get someone else into the conversation. Antonia Tully is National Coordinator at the Safe at School campaign. How much do you agree with what you're hearing? Good morning.
Well, I'm possibly agreeing with a little bit of it. I mean, can I just say straight away that my campaign is opposed to making sex education compulsory because we believe that parents must have the choice as to whether their children are in these classes or not. And, you know, parents are the first educators of their children and they are natural sex educators.
Are they?
The best protectors of children are their parents. And I would like to see more schools getting involved with supporting parents in talking to their children about...
But what if the parents don't do the talking, Antonia Tully?
Sorry?
What if parents aren't doing the talking? They're embarrassed or it's not within their culture or...
Well, this is the big myth, that parents either can't or won't talk to their children about sex. The parents I talk to, and lots of parents, and there are studies confirming this, parents can talk to their children about these issues, and they do talk to these issues to their children. And critically, parents are the experts on their own child, and they should be the ones deciding when their child is ready to hear about these issues and what they should be taught.
You're not being a bit utopian here, are you? Obviously, in a perfect world...
I'm not being a bit utopian. And can I just say that, particularly in primary schools... Parents need to be aware of the sort of materials that are used to teach children. For example, video animations of sexual intercourse, talking to children about masturbation, ejaculation. These are very graphic presentations of sexual information in the classroom.
And what age group are we talking about with
these?
We're
talking about, well, from four onwards.
What, they're not showing images of intercourse to four-year-olds, are they?
They're showing, they're getting four-year-olds to annotate sexual organs.
Jane Leacy, is this down to you, Jane?
7 to 9-year-olds, video presentations of sexual intercourse.
Oh, let's get
need to be aware of this.
Well, you made the aware. Antonia, give me a... Jane Leacy, is this down to you?
No, it isn't down to me or any other person involved in...
you can't agree with animated sexual cartoons for four-year-olds.
No, that's completely untrue.
Antonia, you're telling lies.
Untrue.
No, you look at BBC Active SRE programme, you look at the Channel 4 Living and Growing, you look at the Christopher Winter Project. These are programmes widely used in primary schools throughout the country. Four-year-olds are not being shown animations of sexual intercourse, but 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds are.
Jane?
It's up to schools which materials that
Antonia's right. Antonia is right.
She's not right. She's not right.
Well, you just said it's up to schools on an individual basis. So if I'm a mad teacher and I want to have seven-year-olds watching cartoon sex or masturbation, I can do it.
It's not down to individual. It's not. Let me finish. It's not down to individual teachers. Schools are required. One of the few things they are required to have is a policy, and that policy covers the resources that they use. The resources have to be age appropriate, and schools that do well have a wide discussion about the kind of resources that they want to use.
I do sense then at the heart of it, our central point, Antonia might be right. I must leave it there. I'm very grateful for your input. Thank you. Jane Leese, from whom you heard first, is chairs the Sex Education Forum. Antonia Tully is the national coordinator of the Safe at School campaign. Compulsory sex education, pornography, and even these weird animated cartoons.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Come to what we were planning right now, which is this story on sugary drinks, which I've mentioned a couple of times. Indeed, it was on our review of the front page. It's on the front page of the Daily Mail. They should be taxed at 20% to tackle the obesity crisis. A landmark report is being hailed by the BMA, that's the British Medical Association, urges Downing Street to take on the food industry. All your luck. The BMA's proposed levy on fizzy drinks and sugar-laden juices would help subsidise the sale of fruit and veg, they say. The report will pile pressure on ministers who've repeatedly rejected the sugar tax. It would raise the price of a 1 litre bottle of Coke or Pepsi or any of those other drinks from £1.50 to £1.80, and a can of Red Bull, the paper helpfully points out, would go from £2 to £2.40. How frightened should we be of sugar? Angela Levin is a journalist. You'll catch her in the Daily Mail, the Daily Telegraph, Newsweek and elsewhere. Joins me now. Angela, how frightened are you of sugar? Good morning.
I'm very frightened of sugar, actually. I used to love sugary things, and I decided to slowly cut down because I've read lots about it, and it does you no good whatsoever. Sugar is empty calories, so you're not helping your body.
How easy is it to give up? I don't know whether you're the sort of lady who has two in a tea or coffee or whatever, but how easy is it to give it up?
But it is an addiction, so putting a tax on it is a bit of a waste of time. They've tried on rats, that they've got rats addicted to cocaine, and they offer them sugar or cocaine, and they go to sugar. So that will give you an idea. I mean, we're not all rat-like, but it gives you an idea. But the other interesting thing is the government is very, very weak on attacking manufacturers. The world's expert on salt, Professor McGregor, has tried for decades to get the manufacturers to cut down. And the government keeps shelving it. They keep writing reports and they put it on a higher and higher shelf. And the coalition stopped it. So I hope this government will actually have the strength to deal with the manufacturers.
Why? Is it the role of government to bully us like this?
No, I hate nanny government. I hate nanny state.
But aren't you just advocating it, Angela?
No, not at all. I'm saying they should tackle the manufacturers because people don't know what they're buying. You know, tomato ketchup, for example, has got a very high sugar content. Baked beans.
Well, isn't it up to people to find out?
It is up to them to find out, but I think it's up also to give them information so that they can help themselves, because I don't think many people know. But if they look at ingredients, the first one has got the most content, and if you go down, you see where it is. So you've got to learn to do that. You know, cereals, you can cut down, but you get so used to the taste that you want more and more sugar in it.
I know, that's often the problem. Angela, thank you. Angela Levin, who's a journalist you often catch in the Daily Mail, Telegraph and Newsweek. Listening to that, Mark Littlewood, who's Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs. Could you imagine the government deciding to get tough with the food industry, Morning?
I hope not, Nick. I mean, I wish the British Medical Association would stick to medicine and not veer off into taxation and fiscal policy areas. The particular problem with a tax on sugar or a tax on fat, it's twofold, really. Firstly, it tends to hit the poor. Those people who write BMA reports are usually fat, six-figure salaries. Well, it won't affect them too much if a can of Coke goes up from 60p to 70p or so. But it does affect those who are on very tight budgets. And you therefore tend to get, the second problem is this, that people on low budgets then alter their behaviour, that perhaps rather than buying a premium brand of sugary, fizzy drink, you just spend the same amount of money buying a lower, cheaper brand that will actually have as much sugar in it. So it might actually just attack very famous household brands like Pepsi or Coca-Cola, and people might just move to the local supermarket brand. So it probably wouldn't even have the effect of reducing sugar intake for those who want to take it.
Isn't it the role of the BMA to try and make sure that we're all healthier, though, Mark, surely?
I think it's the role of the BMA to advise us. I mean, we should listen to doctors and medical experts. Sometimes I feel, just as a consumer who is not a medical expert of any size, shape or form, that you get too much of a blizzard of contradictory information, that, you know, one day you're told that a sort of a glass of wine a day can do you good, the next you're told you should only drink two glasses of wine a week. So you sometimes get rather contradictory information in this space. But I don't really think that the BMA should be advising on tax and fiscal policy any more than George Osborne in his budget last week should have told everybody to make sure they eat their vegetables with dinner.
Thanks, Mark. Mark Littlewood, Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs. The poor diet, use of sugar, costs the NHS £6 billion a year. It's reported to claim 70,000 lives. And just to finish the numbers, I asked you, a can of Coca-Cola or Pepsi, the regular size can, 330 ml, has got, I asked, was it 3, 6 or 9 teaspoons? It's 9 teaspoons of sugar. Holy moly, that's a lot of sugar. Wow. Mary's in Puckridge. Have you cut out sugar? Hello.
I don't really take sugar, Nick. I used to take...
Well, you probably do, but you don't realise it.
Say again?
You might do, but you don't realise it.
Oh, I know. Putting sugar in your tea, I'm talking about that.
Yeah.
Other than that, I eat perfectly normally.
Yeah.
Some people say I eat too well.
How can you eat too well? What does that mean?
Well, because I've just been told I can have full cream, full butter, whatever. I must eat as much as I can.
You've got to eat as much butter as you can?
Yeah, as much.
Who told you this?
I can't tell you the reason over the phone, but anyway.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I apologise.
No problem.
Okay, I apologise. Right.
But I have... you know what it's like. I would...
What?
For me to sort of try and help, I would put weighing scales in the reception. You know where you have to sit in the surgery?
Yep.
And... anybody who's coming in who's known to be overweight, I'd get them on there.
Oh, I like that. And then make an announcement from the reception.
No.
Bing bong! Yes, just to let you know, Nick Ferrari just took the scales. At 27 stone 7, he's gained 8 pounds, and then everybody points and laughs.
Oh, Jean, bless you. You've lost 2 pounds this week.
Yeah, but what if she's gained 7? Look at you, great porker. Try the salad bar, love.
Fish up you. And then the next one gets on there, and they put on 7, and you say...
You say, what? What was that? Eating? Was it? What? It was a toot, was it? No, I thought you were eating something. I thought you were eating butter again. No. Let's do it my way. And preferably there's a video display screen outside the surgery on the street.
No.
And then we humiliate people who are fat.
And I sat on a plane, right?
Well, many people have.
I paid my ticket next to somebody who's got their elbow in my chest.
Why?
Because they're overweight.
Well, that's ridiculous. They should have to buy 2 seats.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think there now needs to be a weight requirement so that if you do are too heavy, you buy two seats.
Listen,
that's at the back of the plane. I don't know what goes on down
there.
Think
tank and make me part
of it. Get food.
We'll sort it out.
You got it. Look after yourself. I hope your condition improves, whatever it might be. Thank you. Johnny's in Brixton. You're on the wireless, Johnny.
Yeah, oh, the irony. I'm going to do a blog dedicated to you. God, am I going to have my... I'm going to rent my spleen.
Or even rent your spleen. That would be even more interesting.
Yeah, all right. You give me a left hook there, and I'm holding firm Peter Griffin. I watched Family Guy the other day. I instantly thought of you.
I don't know why I don't look anything like him, but anyway, go on.
How he gets away with it, I'll never know, Seth MacFarlane. But if we all want to be allegedly healthy, and it won't happen because the food industry is billion-pound industry.
I think you're right,
I'm right. And it controls... No, I'm 100% right, Nick. Pay attention. It controls the politicians. Of course, you're going to say, don't do conspiracy. They have lobbyists, especially in America. So, if you want to eat healthy, like I try to do, mm-hmm. 5 days a week... you paying attention? Got a pen?
Yeah, I've got a pen.
Good. Get one of your people to write it down for you.
Yeah.
What
is it we're going to write? What are you going to tell me? You know, I don't know what it is we're writing down.
Oh, all right. Have you heard of a device called the Bullet? What's the Bullet? It's a massive food processor.
Oh, yeah, hang on. Yeah. Is this where you blend all your fruit or something?
Yeah. This is a way for the kids and people like me who load vegetables. This morning, after I went training, I had spinach, cucumber, celery, kale.
Oh, my God. What do you do? You put sugar in at the start or at the end?
Don't be ridiculous. No, we don't, darling.
Syrup.
I had that, and it's got all the good nutrients. I'll probably have one later this afternoon.
If you think I'm going to drink something you drop off at reception, you honestly think I drink something? Johnny's made this for you, and there's some toxic-looking green gunk.
I'm sure, and I'm going to be very delicate now, you've swallowed worse in your life before.
Well, there's always that thought. Thank you. Well, I tell you what, one of the staff will have the first swig, and providing she doesn't drop down dead, I might give it a go. Johnny, we'll talk soon. Look after yourself. Thank you. On to other matters. We saw this in our review of the newspaper. The children's charity struck a private deal with the Labour government to avoid a £700,000 tax bill after failing to hand over money it had deducted from its employees' pay. Let's speak with a journalist who's very much in the vanguard of this story, and he's a good friend of this programme, Mars Goslett, a freelance journalist. He was writing in one of the papers yesterday. It's a story he's been chasing for some time. Mars, which is the charity we're talking about? Morning.
Morning, Nick. The charity is Kids Company.
And what's happening
it's
there?
Run by Camilla Batman-Gellidge. Well, it's been under pressure for some time because the Cabinet Office has said that it's going to withhold a £3 million grant until the chief executive, Camilla Batman-Gellidge, steps down as chief executive. And so really, the charity and the Cabinet Office have been locked in a battle for about 10 days now over the future running of the charity.
But how would a charity be able to... And I appreciate you don't know the answer to this, but I'm just thinking aloud here, Miles. How would a charity be able to do a deal with the previous government to stop paying £700,000 in tax? What sort of power or influence does it wield?
It's a very, very good question. When I was looking back through the accounts of the charity, I stumbled upon this extraordinary piece of information that the government had effectively in 2003 let the charity off £589,000 worth of unpaid employment taxes on condition that it paid the outstanding £100,000. So the total amount that the charity seems to have withheld from the government was £700,000. I mean, it does raise major questions about how this money was spent, whether anybody within the government bothered to find out how the money was spent. Does this financial irregularity amount to fraud? Who would be liable in law? Why did the government think it was appropriate to do a secret deal with the charity, which you know, effectively meant that public money was being used to plug a hole? I mean, this also undermines Camilla Batman-Gellidge's claims that Kids Company has passed 19 years of independent audits without fault. I mean, it looks very much like that is not the case.
And what of Miss Batman-Gellidge at the moment as chief executive? She remains in post currently?
She remains in post. She has said that, you know, she's not prepared to name her departure date. So presumably this £3 million grant, which the Cabinet Office had offered the charity is going to be withheld until she does stand down.
Mars, thank you. Come and see us again soon. Mars Gosler, freelance investigative journalist who contributed, indeed, led the coverage in yesterday's Mail on Sunday and has been in the vanguard of that story since it first began. All right, let's come to some of your emails, texts and tweets coming to you. Harry, you're going to be our next caller regarding sugar. This comes in from Tony at Westgate. You've talked about Coke, Pepsi and Red Bull. You should have a look at Lucozade. Actually, I can have a... Oh, my word. Lucozade. I've drunk this. Lucozade Energy Pink Lemonade. Do you have any idea how many... That's extraordinary. Tony, thank you. I didn't know that.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
British Muslims should challenge imams who refuse to condemn Islamist extremist acts, such as the massacre in Tunisia, so says Business Secretary Sajid Javid. Here's a little of what he told the BBC.
I do think that there are too many people, let's call them non-violent extremists, that feed this ideology. They may not agree with the terrorism.
The idea of an Umar and the Muslim
but they,
state.
Yeah, but they might agree with the narrative. And we've got to realise the damage that they're doing. You know, they are, in that case, you're almost, it's like taking a young person to the door of the terrorist. If you're a Muslim parent and you send your children to a mosque, if the imam in that mosque hasn't condemned what happened in Tunisia, for example, you should be asking yourself, why hasn't he done that? Mm. You know, what stopped him from doing that? You know, these are the kind of questions I think Muslims should be asking themselves.
Oh, is that Sajid Javid? The other voice you heard was Andrew Marr. Dr. Afzal Ashraf is consultant fellow of the Royal United Services Institute and joins me now. Is Sajid Javid right, would you say? Good morning.
Good morning, yes. What he says seems perfectly reasonable and sensible. It's in keeping with what the Prime Minister said a few weeks ago and also in keeping with the information that those of us who studied extremism and radicalization over the last, in my case, 16 years or more, have come to that conclusion.
How likely is it?
How
likely is it that there are a number of imams in Britain who are refusing to condemn such acts, do you imagine?
Well, it's a certainty. We know, without naming names, several who are actually more than refusing to condemn have actual sympathies with these organisations and these people. The problem we have here is that there is an extremist political movement which inspires Al-Qaeda, inspires Daesh, that is masquerading under the cloak of the religion of Islam.
Just to explain to listeners, Daesh is another way of explaining it, IS or ISIL, isn't it?
That's correct, yeah.
Why, just out of interest, why do you choose Daesh and how? Because there is a bit of a sort of, not a row, there's a, oh, I don't know, a lack of knowledge, I guess, in the media as to exactly what one should call ISIL or Daesh. What informs you to use Daesh?
Well, it's the reason I use it is simply to avoid giving them the cloak of legitimacy that they wish to have by declaring themselves Islamic and declaring themselves a state. And whatever they're doing, it doesn't conform to my understanding of Islam. I would never presume to decide somebody else's faith, but it doesn't...
You have in this case, though, I think, haven't you?
Well, no, there's a subtle difference here, Nick. Well. What I'm saying is I'm not declaring them non-Muslims, but I'm not recognising their claim that they have declared they've created an Islamic state, and that is a very important difference. I don't think it's right for anybody to decide anybody else's religion, but I do not accept that what they're doing is Islamic, because the basic concepts of Islam are totally against this. And this is the sort of thing that imams, I hope, up and down the country, and I'm pretty confident many are doing at the moment, is saying to their congregations that Islam teaches respect, love and loyalty. Above all, it teaches the sanctity of life and justice and the rule of law. and that it, particularly during the month of Ramadan, fighting, even legitimate fighting, is hugely discouraged. Even verbal conflict is discouraged, so that people should concentrate on the meaning of creation and the meaning of life. And what we're seeing here is organizations such as Daesh and Al-Qaeda and others actually accelerating their killing, because according to their interpretation of Islam, a day's worth of fighting is worth 10,000 nights of prayer, which is a perversion, a misinterpretation of hadith. So for all of those reasons, I think that it needs to be condemned, and needs to be imams and others have a role in educating the basic principles of Islam. And if they did that, they would be, by definition, isolating their congregations from this sort of poisonous ideology.
And lastly, when Mr. Javid said yesterday he agreed David Cameron was right to warn, he feared too many Muslims, and I'll use his words, quietly condone extremism, how accurate is that?
Again, it's very difficult to put a figure on it. But when you look at particular cases, and I've studied over the last 16 years several cases of extremists in the UK and elsewhere, almost without doubt, they have people around them, family members, friends, often community leaders, who do not condemn violence to the extent that they should.
I will leave it there only for time reasons. Doctor, thank you. Dr. Afzal Ashraf is Consultant Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Let's come to calls on that, actually, come in at quite high volume. Dan in Portsmouth, you're first up. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Good show again, Nick.
Just a quick one.
What I'd like to know is, when these guys come on, like that last chap, he sounded like a really nice guy and had a decent things to say. But I wonder, when they come on there saying how respectful and peaceful and how Islam completely condemns what's going on and blah, 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 you know what I'm getting at. Yeah. Why do they never, ever, ever refer to actual history and actual scripture and the way Islam was actually born in the 6th century and the way Muhammad and his followers actually spread the word of Islam? I mean, you can't argue that they were Muslims. You can't argue that they didn't know what they wanted Islam to be, and they did it in exactly the same way that ISIS is doing it now.
Many faiths have pretty gory pasts, though, don't they, Dan?
Yeah, but that's its very conception. That's from the main man. That's from the top guy who Muslims today still revere and consider to be the perfect man. And that's the way he wanted Islam to be spread, by the sword and with terror. So if you want to turn around and say, listen, we've changed that now. We don't agree with the initial stages of Islam. We don't agree with the way it was conceived. We actually don't agree with the teachings of Muhammad. We think it's changed. We've changed it with time and knowledge and education. And this is our new Islam. If they say that, then that's fair enough. Then there is a new Islam. But all the time they're still preaching from the same book, which hasn't been changed in 1,400 years. You know, they can't say that it isn't right. They can't say that it isn't, doesn't just want to subjugate, because they're still learning and teaching from the same book.
I see what you're saying. It's the legacy. So where is the reinvention? Very good points, cogently put. Many people would disagree, of course, Dan. Thank you. Patrick in Coulston, you're on the radio. Hi, Patrick.
Yeah, good morning, Nick. Nick, we have to be careful of going down the route of, like, the thought police. We live in Great Britain. We are a free nation. How we act is governed by the law, but what we think is our personal conviction. I don't believe that it is...
You'd want everyone to, obviously, to attack and to condemn the killings in Tunisia, wouldn't you?
No, not everyone, because we are all different. There are certain people that are at the forefront where it's their job to do that, and there are other people whose job it isn't. I feel to speak outwardly about Islam. I don't about anti-Islam. I don't expect everybody to do the same. That would be an unfair proposition to make. People have the right to do and feel how they want.
But I'm sorry. If you're an imam, you're in a position of respect and indeed authority within your mosque. I think we have a right to know that you condemn what happened in Tunisia.
Nick, what I will do, right, okay, is draw an analogy for you. Throughout the course of, I don't know, recent history, we've had issues with Roman Catholic priests and children.
We have.
There was a period of time where the Roman Catholic police categorically denied the fact that there was an issue. Now, this isn't the same as mullahs or imams not speaking out against Islam. The best thing that they can do is actually promote what Islam actually is, rather than go on a crusade in respects to what Islam isn't. There's no necessity in law or in the job description to do that. It's ridiculous.
But I want it to happen.
Yeah, just because you want it.
Well, no, I don't. Sajid Javid wants it. He's the business secretary. The Prime Minister, I think, is probably motivated towards it. Well, why on earth would you want this country having imams who were supporting what happened in Tunisia?
No, but that's just it. I'm not saying that they are.
Well, that's the flip side of what you're saying.
Absolutely not. Just because I don't speak out on something doesn't necessarily mean I agree with it. I didn't agree with us bailing out the banks, but I didn't speak out about it because I knew that it was a pointless task. But it isn't an imam's responsibility to speak out against something. It's an imam's responsibility to lead and show what the thing that they represent is.
I'm a British Muslim, born and bred in Leeds originally.
Oh, yes.
My views are very, very strong. Totally condemn anything. Anything that these things that get publicised about, whether it's ISIS or whether it's anything that think that they're Muslim, they're not.
Right.
Because what the other gentleman just said is that if you go back to the scriptures and the Bibles and the Qurans and any scripture, you have to remember it was all gruesome back then, not just the Quran.
Right.
All religious kind of, anybody who preached a bit of religion, just like Jesus, he was crucified, it was gruesome, wasn't it?
We don't believe you. Gruesome, did you say? Yeah, absolutely gruesome.
I think, yeah, it was. It's not normal. I mean, why would you? Only because he said he was a prophet.
Yes.
So they wanted to kill him. I mean, in Islam, we believe that back the scriptures, going back to what the gentleman said, it was only on. You could only kill somebody in war, on the grounds of war. It says, be good to thy neighbour, be good to that elderly or a mother or a child. Do not harm anybody.
Mm.
That is not going to harm you. You know, the Quran is such in-depth scripture. You have to be very intelligent to understand. You can't read a paragraph and take it for what it is.
All right. Kamila, thank you for giving us that very important interpretation. Hikmut in Romford on this. You're on the radio, Hikmut.
Yeah, hi, Nick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nick, what my point is that all these imams in this country and all around the world, my dad was an imam, and he is a sad story to tell, but he got killed because he condemned terrorists. I'm Kurdish from north of Iraq.
Right.
My brothers, sisters, and all my family are fighting firsthand with them terrorists every day, day, night.
Right.
And what I believe, whoever don't condemn it, especially the imams, they supporting it. There is no two ways about it. There is no two ways about it. And all these poor kids, I would never, ever in my...
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.